This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to the TLS's Turning Leaves podcast with me, Alex Clark, and the TLS's arts editor, Lucy Dallas. As listeners to the weekly TLS pod will know, Lucy and I love nothing better than veering off topic to talk about gardens. And in this occasional series, we bring together books and horticulture. In other words, we've made our work accommodate our enthusiasm, haven't we, Lucy?
I would prefer to say that we've plugged a much needed gap.
Also, I suppose we should say, as our bosses are listening, our work is our enthusiasm.
Exactly.
But well, it is a great pleasure to do this podcast, isn't it? And especially at this time of year, because, well, I don't know about you, there's a lot of dreaming goes on in the depths of winter, a lot of planning.
Mind gardening. I think we mentioned it at one point. There's a book by, can I remember her name? Mirabel Osler, I think. And she talks about mind gardening. I might have got that completely wrong. If I have, dear listeners, do write in and tell me. But yes, since we're in the depths of winter, we're not doing physical gardening so much, but we're very much thinking and dreaming about it. And yes, this allows us to talk about books and gardens.
And let's face it, in winter, nothing has gone wrong yet. You know, well, everything has come up beautifully.
It's potential.
It's all potential. Have you got a big plan for next year?
I do. I've got a new bed. When you say big plan, I've got a teeny, teeny, tiny London garden. So it's not physically big, but in my mind, it's giant. How about you?
Well, you know, I've got a bit of a boggy field. So it's larger, but not necessarily more manageable. So I have a sort of larger bed in mind that I hope is going to try and soak up some of the water that has gathered, because we've had a lot of water.
Maybe you can. We're not supposed to be doing this. We're supposed to be getting onto the subject at hand, which we absolutely will. Can you grow loads of gonorrhea so that it's just like a lovely, wonderful prehistoric sort of forest?
That would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Anyway. Would you come and see me then, Lucy?
Anytime, Alex.
Now, we can't distract ourselves from our distraction, can we?
No, really not.
So in the opening episode of this podcast, we chatted to novelist Dame Margaret Drabble and her son, gardener Joe Swift. And today we have another family pairing, not to mention another dame, with Penelope Lively and her daughter, Josephine. Penelope is the author of numerous acclaimed novels, including the Booker Prize-winning Moon Tiger, According to Mark, and Family Album. And she's also a memoirist, with books ranging from her account of a Cairo childhood, Oleander Jacaranda, and 2018's Life in the Garden. Josephine is a professional musician and a dedicated gardener, and both mother and daughter are trustees of the Gulsenkopf Foundation, established from the legacy of Penelope's aunt, artist Rachel Reckitt, to promote the arts. We were absolutely thrilled when they agreed to talk to us on Turning Leaves. Keep listening and you'll understand why. Penelope, you've written so evocatively and so much about the gardens that you encountered and lived in as a child. And I wonder if you could start us off by describing your garden in Cairo and how much it made an impression on you when you were very little, and especially the sense of it being this small enclave of cultivation outside the main city.
Extraordinary, really, because it was three large houses, all with largish gardens, which I think had probably been built about 1900. And then right outside Cairo, several miles outside the sort of edge of Cairo. And so that the surroundings were what we called the cultivation. And it was the fields of sugarcane and bearseem and canals. There was one big canal near, and then there were sort of tributary canals. And we had a ditch running down one side of the garden, which periodically the gardeners were allowed to open the side of it. And water could flood into our garden. It was called the flood. You could only do that occasionally because water was so severely rationed and it was needed more for the crops. Anyway, but the garden itself was big. I mean, I remember it as huge, and I think that it was quite big. I can draw a map of it even now. My mother was a very good gardener and she had designed it. It was very much an English garden. It had lily ponds, it had clipped topiary, it had a pergola walk, and there was a wonderful water garden of sort of bamboo with an island in the middle. And there were formal beds, yes, formal rose beds. The planting, of course, had to make a bow to where we were. So it was sort of Mediterranean planting. There would have been poinsettias and zinnias and cineraria and bougainvillea, that kind of thing. I spent most of my childhood in it, really, because the Egyptian climate is such that you want to be out of doors most of the time. So I was, and I was being home educated after a fashion. So until I was 12, that was where I'd spent most of my time.
And did you remember, I mean, the way that you describe it, it sounds as though your mother must have spent so much time on it. Do you remember her, you know, as being a gardener, sort of almost primarily, I wonder?
My mother spent much time telling other people what to do in it.
Right. Brilliant.
This was the time of a service, and I can remember there was the head gardener was Mansour, and I was actually rather scared of Mansour because he knew that I could get up to things like picking out those orange stems in the middle of arum lilies and that kind of thing, and then he would shock me to my mother and I'd get told off. But there was Mansour, then there was Ali, who did the sort of the heavy lifting by way of mowing the grass and that kind of thing. And then, most important of all, there was the gardener boy who was called Mohammed. And he was, I think he was about my age, not much older. And his job was sort of desultorily sweeping paths and things. But we would get together a lot for kind of things like competitive hopping and so forth until Mansour spotted and he was sent back to work again. So my mother was mainly directing operations. I don't frankly remember ever digging or planting. She cut flowers for the house, that kind of thing. So she knew what she was doing all right. She was a good gardener, but she wasn't a hands-on gardener in the sense that that I've been or that Josephine has been.
Mm. Although, actually, Mum, if I could just come in at this point, because that was in Egypt, which obviously I never saw the garden in Egypt, but my grandmother then spent much of her life in Malta. And I do remember the garden there, which was absolutely magical. And she did make that herself. She was very hands-on there. So I think she started out not hands-on, but ended up, I remember her always in the garden and watering it for hours every evening. And it was a lovely garden full of orange trees and lemon trees and all sorts of exotic things. So I think she ended up becoming a hands-on gardener, but didn't start that way.
I'd sort of forgotten that, yes, because I don't think she had much of any help with the Malta garden. So you're dead right, yes, at that point she was.
Josephine, tell us how a bit more about that, because it sounds fascinating. She went from Egypt to Malta And what do you, how old were you? What do you remember about it?
Well, she ended up in Malta after being in London for a bit. And I think I remember first going there when I was, my mum, it might be wrong about this, but I was about 8 or 9.
Yeah, about that, possibly 7. I think you were about 7, actually.
And I just remember we arrived at night and we went through this door and there were orange trees and lemon trees with actual oranges growing on them. And I'd never, ever seen anything like that. I mean, I don't think I even realised that oranges actually did come from a tree. I just thought it was completely magical.
Did it smell amazing when you walked in? Could you smell them?
I don't remember that, actually. I just remember the sight of these oranges on the trees, and it was all beautifully lit up as well. She had lights going through it.
Oh, yes, yes.
So it did look lovely.
Mm. Did she have, were there in either of these gardens, roses? Because I would like to ask you about roses, because you are, as far as I can tell about this, you are the only living author to have a David Austin rose named after you. So,
well, this completely amazing thing. Yes, it happened this year. I had this email from David Austin's office saying that David Austin, of course, read roses, and every year they launch a new rose and they give it a name. And this email said that this year's new rose they would like to call Penelope Lively. Would that be all right? Heaven's sake, would it be all right?
I would have thought that's better than getting a Nobel Prize or just anything.
I remember sending back the most incoherent email saying, oh, yes, please, yes, please. So, yes, well, actually, back Egypt, there were roses. There were formal rose beds. Malta, I honestly can't remember. I don't think roses would have been very happy in Malta, so she may have been careful not to bother with things that weren't going to be any good. But she certainly managed some in Egypt, yes, although frankly I'd have no idea what kinds they are.
And the Penelope Lively rose, tell us about her a bit, because she's very beautiful. I haven't seen a flower in real life, I've just seen the pictures. It's pink.
She's pink. It's quite a darkish pink. And she's an abundant flowerer. She's not a climber. She's a sort of bush rose. She's a smallish bush rose. And she's an amazing repeat flowerer. But this is a David Austin characteristic. The original David Austin, who's the father of the present one, was intent when he set up trying to breed hybridized roses and breed what he was going to call English roses. He wanted to concentrate on them being good repeat flowerers because he thought that all the old hybrid teas that people had been growing for years weren't very good at this. And so it's a strong feature of David Austin roses that they repeat flower like mad. They flower twice during the summer. And yes, this one certainly does that. The second flowering was almost better than the first.
And it has a super, super structured rose, isn't it? I mean, it's got these fantastic sort of cupped blooms. So beautiful.
That's right, yes, yes. Yeah.
And is it fragrant?
It's extremely fragrant. Oh, it's actually one of the strongest smelling roses I've ever known.
How wonderful. Yes, because I was looking through the others and the other authors are either all dead or a lot of characters from Thomas Hardy who've ended up having a terrible time. So
doomed roses, one might think.
Yeah. I think maybe the original David Austin was a great Hardy fan or something. I've wondered about that. Yes, it's odd. It's rather interesting.
I've actually got Gabriel Oak in my garden. And
how's he doing?
He's beautiful. He's lovely. Dark pink, very dark pink. Very good.
But do you have a Penelope Lively?
Well, I've actually got two, yes.
Good, good. That you feels like you really should have. It would be wrong if you didn't all have them.
I know. They sent us some actually last autumn when they very first told my mother about this. So they sent us some container grown ones, which we could plant out immediately. So I think we were the first people to get them actually. And it's very exciting. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen my mother so pleased about anything, actually.
Well, that seems quite right, too.
I have to say, I think this is going to be yet more David Austin-related damage to my bank balance now, because I don't have one of these roses. And now, of course, I've seen it. I need it. I must have it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
They're available again, I think. They actually sold out at the end of the first week after the launch at Hampton Court Garden Show. At the end of the week, they've sold out. But I know they've got bare-rooted ones available now for planting in November.
Mm. I just have to say quickly, this podcast is not sponsored by David Austin. There might as well be.
It would be good if it were, Lucy.
I know, it would.
Business plan for the future. We could be absolutely surrounded by David Austin roses our whole lives. Anyway, apologies. Carry on.
Yes, sorry. No, I wanted to ask Joe a question. So, Joe, we've heard about your grandmother's garden. How about your childhood gardens, which was made by your parents, made by Penelope? Were they very influential for you? Is there a particular one that kind of struck you or stays with you?
Well, I suppose the garden we had at Church Hanborough in Oxfordshire, because we moved there when I think I was 7 and basically stayed until I was 16. So that was the garden I was there mostly. So that is the one I remember. And it was a big garden and it was very lovely garden. And I did spend quite a lot of time in it, but we were also right in the middle of the countryside. So I also spent a lot of time in the countryside, just all over the fields. And it was very, very lucky upbringing. But I do remember the garden. And I remember my father had a dahlia bed, which seemed to run down the middle of it. It was a long, narrow bed and it had lawn on one side and I think a path on the other, and it was about 3 foot wide, so it was absolutely perfect for jumping over and testing our long jump skills. But the trouble is, I think quite a few of the dahlia buds got knocked off in the process.
I was going to say that I bet that didn't make you very popular, no, doing long jump over the dahlia
no
beds.
It didn't, but it was good fun. I also remember there was a big flower bed and it was called a herbaceous border, and I always just remember that. And I think that's possibly a sign of the times, because I don't think many people these days have herbaceous borders, tend to be mixed borders. But I hope I'm right, Mum. I do remember this one was the herbaceous border.
Well, you see, we were actually in very early gardening days then. We'd only sort of recently learned that we were into gardening. And the herbaceous borders are what you had then, yes. And I can remember struggling with it. But more than that, I remember struggling trying to make a rock garden. Rock gardens were still fashionable then. And my goodness, that's a thing never to do, actually. Don't ever raise a rock garden. Thank goodness they're totally unfashionable now.
Do you know, I do have a rock garden. And not a very big one. It sort of surrounds some steps, some stone steps. And I just really wanted one. And it must have been partly nostalgia. And really what it has in it largely is daisies, large daisies. It's not very rockish, really. But I'm sorry to now immediately turn this into gardener's question time, as I do every time. But I do have a herbaceous border, or at least I've tried to have one. I made one when I moved to, and it was a sort of desolate bit of field. But the problem is it was going very well until an enormous gorse seeded itself into it. What do I do, Penelope?
Ask Josephine, she's the much better gardener than I am.
Josephine, what will I do about my gorse? Because you know how difficult it is to get that out, and I sort of think I shouldn't.
Well, I think it would probably just take over, actually. I've never had a gorse in my gardens, but I think you'd probably just have to try to take it out with a very large spade or get some help.
Yes, I think help is key, and probably everything goes through gorse when you're gardening. I mean, there is no gardening glove invented that can stop injury. But anyway, Lucy, back to you.
I have a strong memory of reading in the garden. I think that's probably why I wanted to do this podcast, basically, because it's a very good place. And when you're reading when you're a child, it's so strong and so enveloping. Do you remember reading in the garden?
I absolutely did, yes. I spent much time reading in the garden because reading on the hill was what I did in this curious home education. I was completely hooked on, of all things, Andrew Lang's Tales from Troy and Greece. This is the Edwardian retelling of the Homeric myths, and it's a wonderful retelling, actually. So I was always stuck deeply into that. Part of the fascination, of course, was that I was in it somehow. I'm Penelope. So, you know, this must be about me in some way, you know, the solipsism of the 8-year-old mind. But my other reading was Arthur Ransom, Swallows and Amazons, amazingly. Those books were just coming out then, and I was riveted by them because they were so exotic. I mean, these children in this place of water and greenery and so forth, I'd immerse myself in this and then look up at my own humdrum world of camels and palm trees and the hoopoe digging in the lawn kind of thing. But I'm trying to remember, Josephine, you were an absolutely avid reader. I can't remember, did you read Arthur Ransom? Did your generation?
Well, yes, I did. I loved it. I wanted to be Nancy all the time. So, but also, I do remember reading a lot in the garden at Church Hanborough, but actually, I used to read up a tree because there was a big, I think it was an ilex tree right by our, by the front gates. And it was perfect. It had a little sort of about 10 foot up, a little place where you could sit. So I used to sit up there for hours reading. So that was where I used to read, very comfortably.
Goodness, do you know, I didn't even know that. I think you kept it secret. I never knew that. And the strange thing is it absolutely mirrors. I used to read sitting at the foot of my favourite eucalyptus tree, which had great spread out roots that made a sort of triangular place that you could push yourself into. So, and I was in communion with this tree. I had a sort of animistic relationship with it. So there we go.
And Jo, what were you reading in the garden? Apart from, were you reading your mum's work or not?
No.
No, she says, family.
not really. I mean, obviously, I did. But no, I think I do remember Swallows and Amazons very, very clearly. And I think I just used to read lots and lots and
you
lots.
You were an absolute passionate Rosemary Sutcliffe.
Yes, Rosemary Sutcliffe. I used to read a big mixture of things because I also rather strangely liked sort of horsey books. I think Josephine Pullen Thompson, which aren't very good. Well, I'm not sure, but they're about horses, which I wasn't interested in and didn't know anything about. So I think it was just reading about something that I didn't know anything about.
We talked about this in another podcast. There's a genre, isn't there, of horsey books. I read a couple of them as well. And I used to read books about the chalet schoolgirls who were in a boarding school in Switzerland. It was as far from my experience as it could possibly be.
That must have been the pull, mustn't it? I mean, I'm sure this is why I passionately read Storky & Co. over and over again. And these sort of schoolboys seemed to me the height of, as you say, a kind of exotic life so far beyond one's own. But it's extraordinary to think of you, Penelope, sitting there reading Swallows and Amazons and thinking how boring your life in this Egyptian garden was.
Yes.
I was going to try and move on to gardens in general in literature, because I know that you've thought about this and written about this, Penelope. You make a point about whether they're integral to the scenery or they're a kind of atmospheric thing, and that you can tell whether a writer is a good gardener from how they write.
I absolutely can, yes. And I think, yes, the garden is a sort of backdrop that doesn't work very well. You somehow know that the writer wasn't a gardener, but you know there are a number of writers who you absolutely know must have been. Oh, goodness. Angus Wilson. There's one of his books, The Middle Age of Mrs. Eliot, particularly is brilliant on gardens, because principal characters are a gay couple who run a nursery garden. This would be back in the sort of 60s, 70s, before the age of garden centres. Nothing so vulgar as a garden centre. And they run this extremely sort of recherche nursery. And all the plants and everything cited in that make me know that Angus Wilson absolutely must have gardened himself. And then I suppose almost, I mean, where I like it best is where the garden is relating to the subject of the book, as it were, memorably. There's the beginning of Rebecca, Daphne du Maurier, where she dreams the garden. She says, last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again. And she dreams this garden that has got completely overgrown. The rhododendrons are 50 feet tall. Ivy is all over everything. There are nettles everywhere. And it's all to do with time having passed, time having gone since when she really was at Mandalay. And then actually that links up perfectly and very oddly with a totally different writer, Virginia Woolf, who particularly amazingly, she was an absolutely hands-on gardener. Her diaries tell you about that. There are wonderful passages about weeding, about the pleasure of weeding. And she talks about the chocolate brown earth under her fingernails when she comes in. But particularly into the lighthouse, there's the bit where the character goes back to the sky garden, the garden that they'd gone to in childhood, and it's completely overgrown. And again, she has very precise ways in which this has happened. Poppies had sowed themselves among the dahlias, and there were giant artichokes towering above the roses, and it's all very precise. And the things that were grown there, and the Fofia red hot pokers, which were very, very fashionable plant then, less so now. So they absolutely. And I think for me, one of my favourites actually is Carol Shields. Carol, she was a friend. We never saw enough of each other, usually had the Atlantic in between us. And sadly, I never had a gardening conversation with her. But I absolutely know from the Stone Diaries that she must have been a gardener, because she has a character there where the central figure, Daisy, takes on the writing of a newspaper horticultural column. And this is absolutely infused with very precise and accurate gardening knowledge. It's very funny as well. And I suppose, yes, again, across the Atlantic, Willa Cather. Willa Cather was amazing on the prairie gardens, that the pioneer characters who were out in the prairie and trying to carve a garden out of the prairie. And then she talks about how they planted fruit trees and they were planting vegetables, and all around the prairie grass is sort of seething all around them. And then completely differently, there's Edith Wharton as well, with rather grand New York gardens. And Edith Wharton, so I don't think she was a hands-on gardener at all, no chocolate earth under the fingernails, but she was an amazing garden designer. She lived in France later on, and she designed and laid out two huge gardens, one in the south of France and one further up. So she absolutely was a garden connoisseur and knew about it. And I suppose the book that immediately would spring to most people's minds is The Secret Garden, is Frances Hodgson Burnett. Mm. No, as far as I'm concerned.
You're not a fan, are you?
I'm not. I find it sentimental, and it descends into whimsy. Although it'd have to be said, the garden stuff in it is all fine, that's good. Now, the great children's book that deals with the garden, of course, is Tom's Midnight Garden, Philippa Pierce, which is one of the great children's books of all time. And it's extraordinary because it has this amazing, elegant narrative, which is about insights into the nature of time and memory. There's the dreamed garden that Tom, the boy, goes into every night. And then in this garden, he meets a little girl called Hattie. And at the top of the house, in the same building he's staying in a flat in, the landlady of the house lives in a flat up at the top. And she is Hattie, you discover at the end. And so the garden is existing in her mind. The real garden exists in her mind. And in some way, this can also become the dreamed garden that Tom has. So it's an extraordinary book, and the garden is described in absolute detail. You could almost make a map of it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Mm. It's a lovely idea, because actually I think that's how we all garden, with some sort of dream garden, don't we? Quite often you're not gardening with a garden that's actually in front of you, which may or may not be full of weeds and holes and bits of stone and slugs. You're gardening with the one you've got in your mind.
No, absolutely. Yes, you are. You're always, you know, imagining something that's going to be better or different. Yeah.
What a reading list you've just given us, I must say. And so interesting about Carol Shields. And I hadn't really thought of her as a sort of gardeny writer, but it makes me feel like I want to go back. And of course, it put me in mind of Larry's Party, one of her best known books, which is kind of about gardening in a way, but it's about this idea of somebody trying to find their way into their life through controlling the garden. It's about a maze maker, isn't it? A man who gets absolutely obsessed with making mazes to the sort of detriment of other parts of his life. And it seems to me in literature is often about that idea of what we can control and how we rather delude ourselves that we can control nature and put patterns on it.
I'm less fond of that book than I am of The Stone Diaries, but absolutely, yes, it's about mazes. And over here, I can remember her talking about the book before she was writing it. And yes, she was visiting mazes in this country. She was looking up mazes. I remember her saying to me, "What mazes do you know?" And I'm thinking, I didn't think I knew any.
It's a good specific question. Tell me about your mazes. It's interesting as well, talking about Willa Cather and the prairie thing, which was what, you know, the things that people could kind of scrape out of the land at the time. And actually, in terms of fashion, A prairie garden is now very fashionable. It's all full of grass.
It absolutely would be, yes. The waving prairie grasses. I don't know what kinds they were. But yes, there's that Dutch gardener whose name I can never pronounce.
Yeah, Pierre Tudor.
That's,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
He was absolutely into that. So, but you need huge space for that, and don't try and make one of his gardens in the foot of a suburban garden, because you can't. You need an acreage. Josephine and I have been to see the garden that he has. Yeah, and I can't remember exactly where it is.
Is it the one in Somerset?
In Somerset, yes, with the it's housed in Worth, isn't it? The art gallery that's there as well.
Yes, I've seen that garden. It's wonderful.
It is, but it's all waving grasses and that kind of thing. It's all about colour and texture and shape, and very, very different to the way that that most of us are able to garden.
Yes, yeah. We should say, shouldn't we, here, Joe, that you've got RHS qualifications. You know about this stuff. You're the gardening expert here.
I mean, only of a fairly lowly sort. I did do the, I think it was the RHS certificate in horticulture about 20, 25 years ago. And then I did a garden design course at Capel Manor in North London, which I really, really enjoyed. But in those days, garden design wasn't done on computer. It was all literally paper and pen and colouring in. But it was a fascinating thing to do. And yes, I learned a lot. I think I already was obsessed with gardening before I did that. And it was a very good sort of antidote to my, you know, musical career and having small children and everything. It was a really good thing to do alongside.
I remember seeing Piet Udolf's plans for some of that garden, because I think they have maybe something about it at Haslingworth, but he does it on paper. He's got these, or it looks as though he's got these beautiful, great, big, huge bits of paper, and he's doing it with felt-tip pens. It looks kind of possible, though, of course. I mean,
yes, just drawing in the colours and things, which looks stunning. And then it is a beautiful garden. I think also it's probably at its best about this time of year, so early autumn, late summer, early autumn, because a lot of the grasses and herbaceous things look their best then, rudbeckias and all those sort of things. So,
Joe, will you tell us a little bit about your life in music, and if that has any bearing on your life outside, as it were, in the garden, your sort of external life?
I spent most of my career being an orchestral oboist, freelancing various orchestras in London, symphony orchestras, chamber orchestras, and also doing quite a bit of teaching, which is what I do now. I don't play anymore, but I do quite a bit of teaching, examining, that sort of thing. But I just think that the gardening just went alongside that as being something completely different. So sort of different timescale, because with gardening, you're always thinking about the future. And I also find that I lose track of time when I'm gardening totally. And it's the only time I ever do, actually. Other, apart from that, I've always got a very good sense of what time it is or how long I've been doing something, but not with gardening. I just suddenly realised 3 hours has gone past. I thought it was about 10 minutes. So I think gardening, it's so different from music. You know, music's very much in the present, and even the time is in the present, because if you're sitting playing, say, in an orchestra, you're actually literally counting time for quite a lot of time. You're counting bars rest and just watching time go in the present, whereas gardening is all about the future. And I've got a lot of musician friends and colleagues who are also passionate gardeners. I don't know if it's a bigger percentage than normal, but it does seem to be a lot of musicians who love gardening, which is nice, because that's what we talk about.
I can see that the concept of time, or the importance of time, is very, very different. But I suppose there is still that idea of things flowing, of a sort of freedom that you have to achieve despite the kind of the strictures around you.
Yes, I suppose. I mean, they're both creative. You know, even if you're sitting down playing from a score in an orchestra, which is a very specific thing you have to do, you're still actually creating your own sound and your own way of playing. And when you're gardening, you're also doing that. You're creating something visual for the future. So yes, they are both creative, and they both do flow. And I suppose gardening doesn't really have a beginning and an end, and neither does music, really.
I feel like there is a correlation somewhere about the kind of obviously, as you said, when you're actually playing the thing, you have to be very present, because if you forget what bar you're in, you know, yes. then there's a problem. Yes. Mm. I suppose it's probably more for listeners. There seems to be, it's, I was thinking about the idea of a kind of suspended present, which is a bit like gardening, in the sense that when you are gardening, yeah, you know, you yeah. could, you forget what time it is. And also, I guess for listeners, probably not for for you as a practitioner, but for the listeners of music, you can have a sort of suspended present. And the yeah. past is involved in that, past gardens and past performances and the future, but probably more in gardening. Is that what you think, that the gardening is more about the future than...
Yes, I think if you're listening to a piece of music, you can get very, very lost and absorbed in it. It takes you out of yourself, and that's what's so amazing about music. And gardening, yes, you're always hoping for the future. You plant something, you're always thinking, well, next year it's going to look amazing, you hope. And also, you know, I'm always writing lists about things I've got to do. You know, I've got to divide this and replant that, and that's all for the future too.
It's often being presented now as a partly as a kind of therapy, which makes quite a lot of sense. But and some of the benefit of it is a sort of mindfulness thing, in the sense that you are in the here and now, because you've got your hands as you said.
Oh, it's being absolutely advocated, yes, as something that people should do as precisely that sort of thing. And it makes me realise that it's exactly what I've been doing all my life, as something to get away from writing. Because, I mean, writing is so different from music. I find myself envious listening to Josephine, thinking that music makes you concentrate in a completely different way. Writing, you do concentrate, but as we all know, you can also get completely stuck. And that was where gardening was a salvation, because when totally stuck, okay, go out and dig the trench for the potatoes. And maybe when you come in, you will be unstuck. So that's where it goes quite well with writing. And I have had writer friends, yes, who found exactly the same thing. I remember I used to be friendly with Thomas Hind years ago. And I remember going on Arts Council tours with him, and the Arts Council person saying irritably, "You and Thomas have talked about carrots for half an hour."
Only half an hour, I would say. Goodness. Penelope, I wanted to ask you about your novel and time, about the novel Next to Nature Art, which I really love, which starts with a sort of almost, if it were a film, it would be a sort of dissolve, because you say, look, here we are, we can see this garden. It's like we could be in 1740 when this sort of country house where the novel is set was first established, and its gardens established with the ha-ha and etc. But in fact, it's 1974, and it almost dissolves. And that idea of time, it's a very funny novel about a sort of, well, a kind of arts community. And, well, just tell me a little bit about Garden Time.
Oh, Garden Time. You're reminding me of that book, Alex. I suddenly thought, goodness, I wish I'd looked at that.
Sorry, apology. I know you wrote it, but you wrote it some time ago.
A long time ago. And it was a sort of send up in a way of 70s attitudes about creativity. Everybody had to be creative in the 1970s. And it was a sort of art center where people went for a course to be creative and create art and that kind of thing. And I remember after it was published, actually, there was a terrible moment when I had opened a letter from a lady who started off, "Dear Penelope, I am wondering if you have ever been to my institution," and to my horror, she described the place exactly like I had described in the book. And I thought, oh, help, you know, libel action, I don't know what. I was able to write a sort of grovelling letter back saying, I've never been anywhere near your institution, which I'm sure is absolutely lovely and completely unlike the awful place in my book. but your question, Alex, was about Garden Time, wasn't it?
Yes.
Garden Time for me is a different kind of time. And I've always thought that perhaps it matched the way people thought about time in the past. Because in one sense, yes, absolutely, you're gardening for the future a great deal. You garden looking back at the past and thinking, last year I used Hawera daffodils in that pot, next year I think Tete-a-Tete would be better, that kind of thing. So it's always a wonderful anticipatory thing that gardening have. You're not stuck in now. You're stuck in. You're not stuck at all. You're looking forward into the future. But there's also the sense in which I think it isn't linear. It's cyclical. Gardeners think in terms of seasons. You think round and round in terms of the seasons. And for me, that exactly corresponds with what an archaeologist I talked to once and asked about how people thought in the past. And he said he was absolutely sure that in the Neolithic, people's idea of time would have been cyclical rather than linear because they were farmers. They were farming, and therefore their time was the farming year. What mattered to them was the farming year, going round and round with the seasons. You didn't look ahead in a linear and straight way that we tend to now. But I think gardeners actually do both. So gardeners are doing something kind of interestingly archaic as well.
Actually, can I pick up from that, from gardening time? There's a wonderful thing that you talk about in your book, Life in the Garden. You talk about gardening eyes or garden eyes. Could you tell us about those too?
I think, well, Josephine should come in here too. Mm. And I think the thing about having gardening eyes is that once you've become a gardener and an addicted gardener, you're interested in virtually anything that grows. So anything that's unfamiliar to you, you find yourself looking at and thinking, what is that? And you need to know what that is. And of course, you look at any garden that you see. That's a matter of necessity. I mean, I'm living in deeply urban London now, but it's an area which is mainly early 19th century terraced houses, which have, again, to use the same word, which have an area. An area is the basement. It's the bit outside the kitchen basement window and the wall of the pavement. And it's amazing what people do with areas. I'm always noticing, looking down into their area, that they have made a little garden there. It's obviously got its own microclimate, so there is quite a lot that you can do. And so people have done amazing things. And so if you've got gardening eyes, that's the kind of thing that you're noticing always. Wouldn't you agree, Josephine?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, I'm always seeing plants and thinking, well, that's a definite must-have, and trying to find out what it is. But yes, I think you do appreciate when people have made an effort with, you know, whatever they've got. Because I noticed the other day I was in Kentish Town, where my daughter lives, in a street where the houses just open straight onto the street, and somebody has made beautiful little gardens around all the street trees by just putting a little raised bed around the bottom of the trunk of each tree and planting beautiful things in it. And that's presumably somebody who hasn't got a garden of their own. So they just thought, okay, I'll do it in the street instead.
You know, a lot of people probably walk past without noticing, but the gardening eyes see it at once. Yes.
And it's that wonderful thing of it's such a small amount of space. It's just a very small amount of earth which is available. And as you say, Jo, someone's seen it and gone, okay, I'm going to put something in there. And then you've walked along and said, oh, look at what they've put in there.
And window boxes. I think a lot of people discover that they're gardeners when they get their first window box and then will hope to progress from that on onto something a bit bigger. But yes, window boxes, something else I notice. I'm a window box noticing them furiously all the time to see what somebody else has done and do I like that or not.
Can I just say, dear listeners, that I'm looking at Penelope Lively's area and it's full of Mexican daisies. It's lovely. So then, have you got an area, Jo?
No, we've got a front garden, a small front garden.
Oh, okay. What have you got in your front garden?
Well, at the moment, I've got a lovely little weeping pear tree. We did have a box hedge that got eaten by caterpillars and box blight, so that's gone. We've got a different one now. And a pyracantha, that which had grown up the house. But sadly, we've had some subsidence in the house, which this area is very prone to. And I think the arboriculturist who came to look at our front garden is going to tell us that we have to cut down everything in it because of the roots.
Oh.
So pretty soon, I think we're just going to have a front garden that will be gravel, or, you know, I have to think about things that are very, very shallow rooted.
Oh dear, I'm sorry to hear about that.
Well, that does bring us to the sort of absolute crux of it, gardening and loss, and the way that it makes you harden up to things having to be ripped out or dying or going wrong. Gardening and sort of failure is pretty important, I've always thought.
Yes, I think it is. Accepting that you have to move on. I mean, we moved on from a tiny, where we first discovered that we, my husband and I, that we were gardeners, the back of a semi in Swansea, and then to the bigger one in elsewhere, and then to the one that Josephine described. So you have to accept sort of moving on from places, moving on from gardens. I think for both Josephine and me, the biggest loss in a sense, but we don't feel we've lost it because we still have it in our heads, is the garden that my grandmother, her great-grandmother, made in Somerset. And she was the first of the gardening line. I mean, I think strongly that gardening is genetic and it runs down the female line. And it was my grandmother who began it back in the early part of the 20th century. And she was much influenced by Gertrude Jekyll and William Robinson. And she made a huge garden in Somerset, which was amazing. It was a lovely garden. But we do have this feeling, and it's still there, and mercifully it is now being very well cared for by another owner, so it has a new life. But Josephine, we've still got it in our heads, haven't we, just like the house?
Yes, yes, and still remember what the plants were and how it looked. And we did actually, when the house was sold, we did dig up some things and took them with us, so we still have... look, quite a lot of the coloured primroses from there, and a very exotic salmon pink poppy that I remember my great-grandmother used to love. So I have, in fact, in my London garden, I've got that poppy here now, which came from that house. So, and I think if we ever move from this London garden, the plants that I really love here, I'm afraid I'll just shamelessly dig them up and take them with me wherever we go.
What do you think about it being genetic, going down the female line? Are you a firm believer in that as well?
I think it probably does, yes. Well, it certainly seems to have done that in our family anyway. I'm just trying to think of some of my friends. Yes, I think it probably does. And there is still this, you know, thing where it tends to be men who seem to like mowing lawns and growing vegetables, which is probably less so these days, I'm not sure. But certainly I think the real interest in plants seems to go down the female line.
It could be nature nurture, couldn't it?
Yes, how things have been. Yeah. But, you know, there are plenty of people who extraordinarily don't seem to be interested in gardening at all, which I think they just haven't discovered it. They don't know what they're missing.
Yes, they're not interested yet. You're absolutely right.
What I like is that I think it's becoming... it's got younger. Mm. It used to be a much more middle-aged thing, but I've been delighted, encouraged by, in the last few years, meeting two in sort of work process, meeting two youngish women in their kind of 30s or so, telling me that they just got their first garden and it had transformed their lives. I didn't realise, one of them said, I had no idea that you can be a gardener. And she said, now it's so important that I'm cheating by thinking about it when I should be working. And so that's really interesting. And I'm wondering if, I think garden centres have had something to do with this, actually. I mean, the garden centre is now a shopping experience, and so it's drawn younger and younger people. And you only have to look at the clientele of the one that Josephine and I go to in North London. And it's very far from middle-aged. Well, I mean, it is middle-aged, but it's also lots of younger people as well. And so that, I think that's a combination of garden centres and also television garden as well.
And houseplants, which used to be a bit, you know, passé, have now come roaring back and are extremely expensive. But also, but sadly, because often people don't have space, so they don't have a garden, so they can have plants inside.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it does depend on having your own little bit of space to get really interested, which sadly not everybody does have. And also if people are renting, there's less incentive really to plan for the future with gardening. Although, you know, some people do, I know, even with rented places, but it is just having that bit of space, because I think I only started really getting interested in gardening when I moved into my now husband's house in Crouch End. And he wasn't a gardener, wasn't interested in the garden, but there was a garden there. And so the first thing I did was clear it. And we actually discovered that the garden went on for 30 feet longer than he realised. He had no idea his garden was as big as it actually was, yes.
What a... So you had this wonderful blank canvas with somebody who just said, well, do what you want.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Oh, how marvellous.
Which is pretty much how it's always been with us in the gardening, actually, which is just as well. I'm very happy with that arrangement.
So it's in the female line in your family as well?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Listen, I think we'll have to stop you. We could obviously all talk about this for the next 4 hours, but I think we might have to wrap things up, unless there's anything that you think, anything of capital importance that we haven't dealt with.
Well, I don't think so. We haven't talked about foxes and snails, but I don't think we necessarily need to. I think we've covered quite a lot. It sounds all right to me.
Oh, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And we should also say, though, that so much of what you've talked about, Penelope, is something that readers can get eyes on in your book Life in the Garden, which is just so wonderful. And especially you were talking about your grandmother. I mean, as a gardener on a slope in a muddy bit of countryside, I was very, very inspired by it. I don't think I can quite go to that sort of Gertrude Jekyll inspired kind of gardening, but it was nonetheless a great comfort that, yes, you could do something with a muddy slope.
Oh, absolutely, yes. We'll have a go at the sunken rose garden, the canal garden with a rill down the middle, the ha-ha at the end of the lawn.
I quite often have a canal garden without even trying, I have to say. But certainly a sunken rose garden is something to be conjured with, and possibly full of, you know, Penelope Livelys and Gabriel Oaks, I think.
Of course. Listen, so we just have to say thank you so much, both of you, Josephine Lively and Penelope Lively, for joining us and sharing some of your wonderful garden talk.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Immense thanks to Penelope Lively and Josephine Lively.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS Turning Leaves podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
And let me remind you that you can subscribe to all the TLS podcasts for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.